Blog Talk Radio.
We are the UR Tennis Network. Our mission is to be the voice of tennis. We enlist a team of passionate enthusiasts to promote our sport. We strive to bring interesting perspectives on the many spins of tennis. Our goal is to provide the learners of our sport with current news and information from many angles. We seek active participation from communities interested in tennis, but tennis is not interested in them. We are expanding our outreach. Tennis is a true lifetime sport that needs to be talked about, and the UR Tennis Network pledges to pursue this idea relentlessly.
Happy Monday and welcome to Blog Talk Radio's UR Tennis Network and the Parenting Aces radio show. I'm your host, Lisa Stone, and oh my gosh, y'all are in for such an amazing treat today. My guest this week is none other than the amazing Nick Saviano. He is an incredibly accomplished coach, an incredibly accomplished player. He works with juniors, he works with professionals, he's played tennis at every level and has so many wonderful thoughts to share with us, so many wonderful philosophies to share, and I feel like you guys are really going to appreciate learning from somebody with the level of experience that Nick brings. Before I bring him on the air, though, y'all know I have to pay the bills this week, so I will go to commercial. I also want to give you the call-in number. That number is 714-583-6853. Again, 714-583-6853 if you want to call in and chat with us. We'd love to hear from you. And also just a reminder that the show does air live for 60 minutes. But at the end of the 60 minutes, it goes into podcast mode and will cease to be live. So if you're listening and we're in the middle of something at that 60-minute mark, you're going to get cut off. But please make sure that you check parentingaces.com this afternoon for the link to the podcast so you can hear the rest of our conversation. So without further ado, I'm going to go to commercial. And when we come back, the amazing Nick Saviano.
Alternative Lighting and Power is a renewable energy solutions-focused company with an emphasis in helping athletic facilities. We would like to upgrade your tennis complex to the 21st century. We offer a range of services that will upgrade your tennis complex. We can use our technology to make your facility virtually disappear from the energy grid. We can provide lights, scoreboards, scoring systems, cooling systems, heating systems, camera systems, covered seating areas, wastewater management, and even new buildings. Our company is located in Houston, Texas, but we provide services to all 50 states and internationally. We would love to visit with you about our opportunities. Please contact Ed Love at 832-549-4193 or email at elove@alternativel-p.com. You can also visit our website at www.alternativel-p.com. We are the sunny side of business.
Welcome back to the Parenting Aces radio show on Blog Talk Radio's UR Tennis Network. I'm your host, Lisa Stone. And as I mentioned before, we have an awesome guest today in Nick Saviano. Nick has been involved in tennis for more than 29 years. He has coached and developed more than 50 ATP and WTA players, Grand Slam winners, world number ones, Junior Wimbledon, U.S. Open, French Open, and Italian Open champions. He's coached 24 USTA national junior champions, 8 foreign national junior champions, and more than 25 ITF junior champions. And those champions came at the Sunshine Cup, the Orange Bowl, and at Eddie Herr. He's currently coaching Sam Querrey, he's working with Sloane Stephens, and on top of all of that, he has an academy down in Plantation, Florida, so the guy is busy, 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 but we are so, so lucky that he could take an hour out of his crazy schedule to be with us. And Nick, I want to thank you so much and welcome you to Parenting Aces.
Lisa, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I'm got so many questions for you, and I want to just share with our listeners that you and I first chatted while I was actually at the U.S. Open, and unfortunately, I missed you when you were there, so our chat came by phone instead of face-to-face, but I feel so incredibly lucky to have had the opportunity to connect with you and to get to hear from you about your philosophies of junior tennis and coaching our kids as they come up. And I'm really looking forward to having you share that with our listeners today.
Well, it was unfortunate we didn't get a chance to speak in person, and I'm looking forward to meeting you in person in the near future. But I did enjoy our conversation, and what I was expressing to you is some very deeply held convictions that I have, which stem from my personal beliefs, which is really the core of my philosophy of coaching. And the first and most important one is that I believe when you work with a young person, it's a sacred trust. And it's a sacred trust to that child, but also to the parents, no matter how difficult they might be. They are entrusting you with their precious child, and you have, when you're coaching, you have the ability or the influence to be able to impact that young person in a positive or negative way. And it's incumbent, from my perspective, that the coach always be looking to do what they think is in the absolute best interest of the child. And I say that, and sometimes people say, oh, well, that sounds nice, but it's absolutely a core belief. So that's what I start everything from, and all the decisions that I make. And in the end, it turns out to be good business long term, because when you're trying to do the right thing for people over the years, it works out better in the long run anyway. But nevertheless, it's an amazing responsibility that a coach has when they're working with young people.
Well, before I pick your brain a little more about that philosophy, would you mind giving our listeners just a brief rundown about your history as a player and as a coach?
Okay, I will. I don't really like to talk about myself like that, but I will anyway. But I started playing tennis at 12. I was not playing full-time till I was 14. I got my first rank in Northern Cal at 14, 07. Then 2 years later, I had a kind of a major breakthrough, got the top 10 in the United States in the juniors, and then I was finished third in the United States in the juniors in my last year of 18. I went to Stanford on a full scholarship, was there for 2 years. I was fortunate enough to make All-American those 2 years. We won the NCAA. Turned professional. I played on the tour for 9 years and then did pretty well. I got top 50 in singles and did pretty well in doubles. And then I retired when my first daughter was born. And by the way, I'm married for 31 years and I have three daughters. One's 29, one's 26, and the other's 24. But after my first daughter was born, that was February 10th, 1984, started coaching, coached privately, worked with a lot of players, starting people like Justin Gimelstab at 8, 9 years old. There's a whole bunch. I worked with a young Jim Courier and Jared Palmer, and there was a whole bunch of kids I was working with privately. Started helping the USTA, became a full-time national coach in 1988. Then after that, well, I was director of coaching for the USGA, then director of high performance coaching education. And so I had 15 years at the USGA, and all along I was working with a lot of players. And then at a certain point, I decided I want to go off on my own, and I started my own academy, which I've been doing for the last about 12 years. So I've been blessed to work with a lot of players, and I want to be clear about one thing is I take credit for developing no players. What I do is I believe I contribute, hopefully, in a positive way towards the development of a player. So even when if I speak about Sloan Stephens, who I work closely with and have since she was 11 years old, I don't like to say I developed her, because the parents are involved, the other people are involved, physical trainers involved, other coaches. So I just would like to say I've contributed to the development of a few players.
Well, that's kind of an understatement, but it's very gracious of you.
Well, it's what I honestly believe. I'm not trying to display a false sense of modesty. I just really believe that, when you're developing a player, how can you say you're developing them when the mother and father are the most important people in their lives? I mean, they're an integral part of the team. And from my perspective, you have to create a developmental team. You have to have people on the same page if you're going to have achieve the goals that you want, which are hopefully helping that child strive for excellence and using tennis as a vehicle by which to accomplish that.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that idea of the team, because I think that's where a lot of us as parents get conflicting information. And I don't know in terms of my listeners how many read articles online, other than I hope they're reading what I post on Parenting Aces, but there's a lot of negative stuff written about us as tennis parents. And I hear it from other coaches, I hear it from other parents, I hear it from outsiders, I hear it from journalists, and I'm just wondering, how do you work with parents in order to form a team that is beneficial to the child and beneficial to everybody involved?
Well, the first thing is somebody has to understand who are the most significant people in the young person's life. I'm talking about if you have 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, who are the most important and most influential? They're the parents in most cases, provided somebody has been blessed to have both parents still alive and healthy and all that. So if you're trying to develop a player and you're really trying to help them strive for excellence, to think to be so arrogant as a coach to think that you're just going to have them, drop the kids off and they're not going to be involved at all, to me, as I said, is arrogant or naive at best. And so it doesn't mean that the parent necessarily has to get involved in the nitty-gritty of forehands and the grips and all of that other stuff. But when you're teaching tennis, when you are trying to get your players to reach their full potential, you must be educating them on a commitment to excellence. If you are talking about a commitment to excellence, you have to be engaged in cultivating and developing life skills. And if you are focused on life skills, using tennis as that vehicle by which to achieve that, the two most important people in that equation, aside from the player, are the parents. So what you want to do is draw them in, not necessarily on whether Johnny should be hitting a semi-Western grip or an Eastern grip or whatever, but draw them in on what the plan is, the philosophy of practice and training and how they should be committed to doing things the best they can, fundamental principles such as, dealing with adversity, preparation for matches, handling winning with grace and defeat as well, being gracious winner and gracious in defeat. A lot of things like that. I mean, you need to have a solid team. And ultimately, for a player to truly be great, they've got to have a good self-esteem, self-worth, and self-confidence. And that has to be built and cultivated, excuse me, in a well-rounded environment.
I agree with you. Without naming names, have you ever had a situation where the parent piece has gotten out of control? And if so, how did you manage that?
Yeah, I deal with that almost daily. And hundreds and hundreds of times, it might even be in the thousands. Look, all of us, as anyone who is a parent, knows it's not easy with our own children. And being a parent, you have to be empathetic to parents about the challenges that they face. I mean, whether it be the financial strains or just the challenge of raising teenagers is not easy. And somebody who raises children understands that. So when you have the component of competition, of a lot of other variables, it's a big deal. So we all, as parents and as individuals, don't always handle the situation perfectly. And therefore, having a coach who has a good, solid, steady philosophy and someone who's supportive of the parents is critical. I do deal with that on a regular basis, the parent overreacting to result. And rather than be critical from the standpoint of saying, oh, you're out of line or this or that, you try to educate. You try to explain what the ramifications are long term. I'll give you an example, if I may.
Sure.
One of the things that I have found, there's some fundamental truths that I've learned over the years, and I try to pass them on. Why? Because it's really important to me. It's important to me to feel like I'm doing something meaningful. Quite frankly, if I feel like I'm just teaching a forehand or a backhand and that's all I'm doing, okay, I get some enjoyment from that if I see it improve. But when I'm dealing with somebody on a daily basis, if I don't feel like I'm contributing more than that, to me, it's not satisfying. So there's many situations where, let's use an example where a parent is getting frustrated with their child and they're critiquing them a lot. I have found that when a child often becomes what you tell them they are not, or whatever you tell them they're going to be. In other words, the more you focus on what they are not and what they are doing wrong, the more they gravitate to that. And I'm not a child psychologist, but I like to focus in on telling an athlete what they are in a positive way and what they can be. Let me give you a practical example. Let's say I'm dealing with an athlete, which I have over the years, somebody who's really tall. And they may, speed may not be their biggest weapon, maybe power. So you wouldn't tell the player, you don't move that well. That's really an issue. You really don't move well, okay? If you say or take that kind of approach, you mentally are going to impair their ability to be all they can be. If you change it around and say, look, Susan, if you can gain a step and a half of speed, which I know you can, and if you can maximize your movement ability, it's going to help you enormously, and you can do that. Now, here I am encouraging them on what they can be, as opposed to what they're not. And that kind of interaction and conversation with a parent, let's say, their child is not moving, their footwork isn't as good as it can be, rather than constantly saying, gosh, your footwork's not very good, your footwork's not very good, you're slow with your feet, they become slow and having sloppy footwork. So that's the way I approach it, is really the antithesis of that, and I think it has a positive effect, and parents usually are amenable to that kind of logic and approach.
Well, it sounds like you come from a place of positive energy and encouragement and love, which, I mean, a parent would have to be crazy not to want that from their child's coach.
Well, I would think, and there's a time to be tough. Make no mistake about it. I will be tough on the kids, but hopefully in a healthy way. When they're striving for excellence, it shouldn't be comfortable all the time. It shouldn't be just a soft environment. You are pushing them to be the best they can be, and that's not easy. And there's sometimes they won't like it, and they won't like what they're doing. And by virtue of striving for excellence, somebody has to be pushed out of their comfort zone, pushed beyond what they think they can do. So it is by no means a soft environment. It is a caring, kind of nurturing environment, but also a very tough one.
Let me ask you about the mental side of tennis when it comes to junior players, because I'm sure that many of the people listening to this have been in situations watching their child play where the child's been hitting really well in practice, moving really well, having some great results on the practice court, and then they get into tournament situations and things just go out the window. And you're watching as the parent, you know your child has the ability to perform at a higher level than what you're seeing. And, I think most of us realize that tennis is so mental. I'm wondering, as a coach, what do you say to a player when you see that happening on a regular basis, and what do you say to the parents to help the parents help the child?
Well, that's a question with a significant amount of information behind it. First and foremost, let me start with this. The mental approach for a child or a world-class player or a collegiate player, the fundamentals of a good mental approach are the same. If you're talking about real little kids that are just getting into the game and going out to have fun, that's one thing. But if you're talking about tournament-level players, people that are competing at the junior level, the collegiate level, the professional level, the principles are the same, and they're not easy for people to grasp. They're easy to intellectually understand, but it's not really easy for people to accept. I will start with one statement that people will have a hard time agreeing with, and then I'll go from there, or many people may not agree. For me, I never want winning to be the top goal for my kids in any competitive event, for any reason, at any time. To me, that is the kiss of death. I mean, that's you're in serious trouble. Now, then you hear people say, well, you're saying winning is important. No, winning is very important. And kids do need to win. They need to have a good win-to-loss percentage. However, you cannot have kids focused on winning when they are competing. You want them absorbed in the process, being focused, executing, staying in the moment, and being committed to playing every point as well as they can. Where the kids go off is they get distracted by the result, by who they're playing, by whether they're supposed to beat this person or not, or they're ranked higher or not. And they're trying, in essence, to control what they can't control. So you don't control the outcome. You influence the outcome. And so I often will use an example. We're in the football season, and if there was 1 minute left to go in the game, and your team is down by 4 points, and you're the quarterback, do you want the quarterback at that point to be thinking and saying to everyone, okay, we got to win. Come on, we got to win. We got to get a touchdown. We got to win. Come on, let's go. We got to win. What good is that going to do them in terms of giving them the best chance to win? It's not. It's going to be counterproductive. It's already a given. Whenever you go into a competitive situation, one of your goals, and remember I said one of the goals, is to win the competition. You want to win. And winning is important and all that. But when it is the most important thing, it takes the focus away from executing. And when that quarterback is in the game, at that point, he's got to be focused in on one play at a time and trying to read the defense and so on. Let's switch it to tennis. You're serving for the match at Wimbledon, and you're a professional. Do you really want to be focused on winning Wimbledon at that point? Of course you do not. You already know you want to win Wimbledon. So what you want to be focused on is what's going to give you the best chance to win. What's going to give you the best chance to grow and improve? What's going to give you the best chance to play as well as you can? And that is by staying in the moment, playing one point at a time, and focusing in on all the things you can control, executing the point as well as you can. And it has a profound impact because not only do you play better, not only will you give yourself a better chance to win, and you're going to win more often, but you're going to enjoy competition. You're going to love being out there and challenging yourself. Conversely, once you're totally absorbed in the winning while you're competing, again, let me digress for a second. I didn't say winning isn't important. It is important. It's not the number one thing. But when you start focusing in on winning, you are no longer focusing in on something you can control. So your anxiety level goes up. Your tension goes up. You'll see this where when young kids are focused on this, or adults or whatever, they start looking for an excuse because the anxiety gets so high, it's no fun, and they start falling apart. And then mom and dad say, gosh, she's playing so well in practice. Well, he gets in the match, and he thinks, well, my coach thinks I should win. My mom and dad know I should win. They're paying a lot of money for lessons. You know, I need to get my ranking up. If you notice, all of those factors are beyond the control of the athlete. And so we have to train the athlete to focus in on what they can control, which will give them the best opportunity to win, to grow, and enjoy the game. Sorry for the long-winded answer, but...
No, it's great. And I just want to ask, though, so how does a junior player practice that? Because obviously... You know, you don't just show up on match day and magically know how to incorporate those skills.
Well, it's a day-to-day practice, and it's a mindset, and it's a philosophy that is instilled on a day-to-day basis, not only with the player, but with the parents. I'm a very competitive guy, and I have no idea how many players that I've been blessed to be able to work with that have won national championships over the years. You know, we list on our website, I think it's up to 26 right now in the last 12 years. But over the years, I've been coaching for 30 years, and I was on the tour for 9 years, and that's playing college for 2 years. And so it adds up to 45 years but that I've been involved in the game. And you have to start this by practice, in practice, and setting the standard. For example, when the kids, I was just out this morning with some players, and telling the kids, the goal is not to just make the shot. The goal is to hit the best shot that you can, given the situation, the highest quality that you can. Execute the point as well as you can. That's the goal. Why? Because that's going to help you develop, and it's going to give you the best chance to win the point. So you start it day to day. And also, you know, what I was getting at earlier when I was saying I'm a competitive guy, I want my players to win. Make no mistake about it. However, you have to get them to be disciplined to stay in the moment. And as I was saying, that really requires day in and day out. I've been speaking with Jeannie Bouchard, who's one of the gals I've worked with since she was 12. And Jeannie is Canadian, and she won a few national junior titles there, emerged as one of their best players, and then she won Junior Wimbledon last year. And we've been speaking virtually before and after every single match all year. And she's done real well. She's went from about 140, 150 at the start of the year, and she's up to 32 in the world. And we go over the same thing every single time before she walks on a court, trying to get her to focus in on the things she can control, executing, competing, all of these basic fundamentals. And here she is, 19 years old, and we're going over the same things that I go over with a little 10-year-old that called me on the phone at Little Mo's.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the things that challenges I have is that the parents of the 10-year-old don't understand, to the extent that they're going to need to, the concepts that are going to give their child the best opportunity to be great. But if they're open-minded and if you're patient and you work together and over a period of time, we all learn and grow in that area, and it helps the child develop.
So is there a language, and I'm putting that word in quotations, you can't see me, but I'm making little air quotes, is there a language that we tennis parents and really sports parents in general should use at home when we're discussing our children's practices, their competitions? I mean, I find myself from time to time getting so worked up over my kids' tennis, and I know I can step outside myself and judge myself and see myself doing it, but sometimes I just I can't rein myself in. And then I wind up going back and apologizing, but
yeah.
I mean, can you give us some words or phrases that are better to use with our kids when we're discussing their upcoming matches or when they come off the court after a match, whether it's a win or a loss, and you know, how to help them take it away from outcome and put it more in terms of process?
Well, yeah, I think you have to often take it out of the context of tennis. I often tell fathers, look, especially parents that are very, very successful in their accomplishments, whether it be financially or otherwise, I say, you know, your child looks up to you, and all they see is success. And they don't see the failures or the defeats that you had along the way and the challenges they you've had along the way. And so what I often say is share your life experiences and also emphasize the life skills and principles that you think are important. So, for example, when and, you know, I'm a parent, and I'm right there with you. There are many times where I would get more, I didn't get that worked up because I kept a pretty good distance from the tennis, but where you say, gosh, I'm too involved in that, in the outcome or the result of it, and so you have to kind of take a moment and back off a little bit. But really, you want to emphasize things. For example, look, if you want to play the game, I'll support you. But this is what I expect. This is what I demand. I demand that you work very hard. You know, you have a really good preparation. I expect that you're going to represent the family well in that you will conduct yourself accordingly. So the attitude and, you know, handling winning and defeat properly. I expect that you are going to compete and fight. Because that's a life skill and a principle that's important. I don't want you ever to be intimidated by anybody. This is not a situation to be intimidated. It's a sport, and just as I don't want you to be intimidated when you walk into the room, when you're in college, or whether it's a group at a party or whatever, I want you to be confident in yourself. See, so you take it out of the context of the specific X's and O's of the tennis. And these are things where a parent can be extraordinarily powerful in what they do to help the growth of the player. Where you run into trouble is where the parent might get into, gosh, you see, your footwork wasn't what it needs to be, and da-da-da-da-da-da. To me, if you have a competent coach, that might be something you say to the coach, say, with the child not around, you say, look, this footwork is awful, and I don't know what we're working on here, but, you know, the footwork's got to get better. And the coach, that's part of his job, be able to explain what's transpiring or why. However, to the child, those life skills that you want to instill in your child, in my view, should be the things that you would want to emphasize. And in doing so, you will really help your child to improve. Now, the caveat to that is that you need them to be looking behind the scenes to make sure that your child is getting what they need developmentally. So the parents need to critically evaluate the coach, not necessarily on the result, but is the training environment the one I want? Is it getting good information? Are the practices well-organized and structured so that my child is getting the opportunity to be successful? Those are some of the things that I think the parents should be doing. And then at the young age, the parent can be more involved on the court, you know, 9, 10, 11, 12. And in a few cases, they can work with their child throughout their career, but that's very rare. And even in that situation, most of the parents, the smart ones, will coach the child up to a certain point, then they'll take a back seat, put somebody else in front and center, and that parent will communicate with that coach, and they're the filter for them where they can allow for the distance.
Yeah, that's great advice. I just want to give our call-in number out again. It's 714-583-6853 if you'd like to call in and ask a question of Coach Nick. Again, 714-583-6853. So, Nick, I want to ask you, have you ever had a situation where you've had to say to a family, you know what, this just isn't working. This relationship isn't working. Your child's not happy. You're not happy. We're not making progress. It's time to move on.
Yes. Yeah, I have.
How did that go?
Well, look, the first thing, I have to follow my own principles. And as I said earlier, there are some times where people, in my view, are not, well, let me digress a second. As I said at the beginning of the show, I have to feel that my involvement is creating a positive influence. And if I don't, for whatever reason, let's say the parents are really pushing the tennis and it becomes a really negative situation for the child, they're not really enjoying it, it's not something they really want to do, I often tell the kids, I'm not out here to pick up a check. I got plenty of people that want to work with me. Unless you want to be out here, unless this is important to you, then I don't want to be out here with you. The number one thing I'll tell the kids, look, I'll go to the end of the earth for you to help you develop, but don't waste my time. And if somebody is wasting my time, meaning they're not really into it, then I have no interest. I will not continue. If I feel the environment is really negative and the parents really aren't, or a parent is really not interested in trying to create what I would consider, you know, a positive environment for their child to be successful. And I'm not saying, oh, they got to do exactly what I'm saying, but where there's not a cooperative effort at all, mm-hmm. and I see it's not as a positive, then I will say that. If I'm not happy with the development of a child, for whatever reason, I will call the parents and say, let's meet, because I'm not happy with the progress they're making in their tennis, or usually it means something else is not going well. So, and I've had situations where parents have been abusive. I've had situations where parents were physically abusive. I've had situations where parents were mentally emotionally abusive. And you do the very best you can to try to help that situation, but I would not continue in a situation like that unless I felt we were positively affecting change in order to eliminate that kind of behavior.
Great. We actually have a couple callers on hold. I'm going to bring our first one on. It's from area code 678-755. Caller, are you there?
Yes. Hello. Hey, Lisa. It's Tim Steels. How are you?
Hey, Tim. How are you? Thanks for calling in.
Great. Hey, Coach. How are you?
Well, thank you. How you doing, Tim?
Doing great. Hey, listen, first of all, I wanted to congratulate you on Jeannie. It's been an absolute joy watching her compete over the last couple months. Her mindset and total focus on the court has been unbelievable, and she's been picking up some great wins, so congratulations on that.
Thank you.
And the other question, you know, I wanted to pose to you, not directly exactly towards Sloan, who you're very familiar with, but just in juniors and in professionals in general, is, and I'm sure it drives her fans nuts, but when you're on the court, the drifting in and out of focus, as it appears, for juniors and you know, at the professional level, what do you recommend to players to try to dial it back in and to get back in the moment? Because it seems like a girl like Sloan, who, you know, covers the court so well and can be so explosive at times, that she just kind of drifts in and out of her focus and kind of lets matches sometimes against inferior players turn into real battles when, you know, perhaps she ought to be, you know, cleaning them up in a little, you know, tidier fashion. So I'll hang up and I just look forward to listening to your response.
Okay. Well, I do know Sloan well, obviously. We're very close. I'm close with the family. I've known them since Sloan was 11 and she was
in the early stages of her tennis career, and so you get close with the family, and they've had some real ups and downs, some tragedies with her stepfather dying of cancer and then her natural father dying in a car accident. So she's had some tough things to deal with over the years. I'll say two things is that, first of all, a lot of times somebody, how they act or perform on a court has more, it's not just about losing focus. Sometimes there's some anxiety involved, tied in with expectations. There might be a multitude of factors involved and that contribute to what is manifesting out on the court. So very often there are bigger issues regarding focus and concentration, and then sometimes there's just simple focus and concentration, which may be a lack of discipline, a lack of maturity, a lack of experience in those areas. So often people also misinterpret what they see on a court. A lot of times people will say, oh, my child is a great competitor. They are down 5-2 in the third, and they fought their way back, and then they lost 6-4, but boy, I mean, they lost 7-5, but boy, they're a great competitor. Well, maybe not. I mean, maybe they shouldn't have been down 5-2 in the third, and that they were, you know, backing off, got down, and then relaxed a little bit, fought hard, you give them credit for that, but then became anxious again. So one of the things, what I'm really saying is that analyzing exactly what is transpiring on a court and what the core issues are is not easy. And very often, it's not just losing focus there. There might be fear, anxiety, self-doubt for other reasons. And so it's a constant building of confidence. That's why I say building confidence and trying to help the person learn to strive for excellence in what they do. And that's a long process. And if you have a good relationship with the player where there's a real trust and bond, they will hear what you have to say. But suffice to say, when I'm working with players and talking about the mental aspect of the game, less than at least 50% of what I'm talking about pertains to life skills that transcend all different sports. So I could be speaking about the skills that they need to acquire, whether it's talking to a basketball team, a football team, a baseball team, or somebody in tennis. The same principles apply. Then 50% of the other is the specifics to tennis. For example, okay, if you feel you're getting anxious or whatever, you're out of the moment, take a deep breath, walk around, look at your strings, you know, bounce around in between, you know, right before you get up to toss the serve, you know, move around, these type of things. So you give them specifics that they can deal with on the court to help refocus and get themselves back on track. And then you also are dealing with more of the life skills development, which helps address larger issues.
Well, that's a great response. Thank you for that. I want to shift the conversation because we're down to a little over 10 minutes left in the show, and a reminder to the listeners, at the end of the 60 minutes, we will go into podcast and cease to be live on the air. So if we go over, please make sure you click on the podcast link this afternoon and hear the end. But I want to ask you two things. One is, you know, we are constantly hearing and reading about the demise of tennis in the U.S., and especially on the boys' side. You know, we seem to have some really talented women coming up and making a show on the international scene. But on the boys' side, the outlook, you know, as we're told from the media, is just grim. And I'm wondering what your take is on that, and what you're seeing, you know, as somebody in the trenches working with these young kids. And then the second piece of that, because I'm going to lump them together, is what impact does the availability of college tennis in this country have on that, or does it?
Lisa, we could talk for hours about this.
I know. I'm sorry. I have to get it in, though.
let me just mention one thing, and I say this with all modesty and humility, is that I was involved with player development before there was player development. And I started helping the USTA in 1984. And I actually helped them write the player development program in 86 and 87. And then they changed what I wrote when they implemented it. But nevertheless, so I was involved. The first national junior training camp I did was the first four guys I hit with, five guys, this is not an exaggeration. The first one was Michael Chang. The second one was Jim Courier. The third, and they were 14 years old. The third was Pete Sampras. Then I think Jeff Tarango. I believe David Wheaton was at the camp. And then at the end, sitting down in the morning, some of the kids asked me if I had hit with Andre yet. And in the afternoon, it was Andre Agassi.
Andre was 15 at the time, and I want to be very clear. I'm not saying I coached all these guys or whatever. I did work more extensively with Jim Courier. I was, you know, blessed to spend some time with him. I spent a little bit of time with Michael Chang at a few events and so on, and I knew them all throughout their career. And I want to tell you a great story. I was on the court very quickly with Andre Agassi on that day, 1984. And he came onto my court with another kid named John Falbo, and I was doing serving on my court. And I said, well, you guys want to work? And Andre said, you know, I don't hit the slice that well. So we spent 5 minutes on the slice serve, and a very talented guy. He picked it up immediately. But, you know, a number of people could have showed him that. So anyway, speed ups for the year that he retired and had that great speech at the U.S. Open.
Mm-hmm.
Something was going on where it was raining one of the days or something, I don't know. And I went with one of my players that I was working with to the practice courts indoors. And lo and behold, Andre's there. And I've seen Andre over the years. I've been to Davis Cup with some of my players. So he had seen me. We'd seen each other a lot. However, he's so famous that I never wanted to put him in an awkward position. So when I come up to him, I always say, Nick Saviano. And so this was right before he retired. And so I walk up to say, Andre, how are you doing? Nick Saviano. He goes, Nick, you don't have to introduce yourself. How could I forget the guy who showed me to hit a wide slice?
Wow.
That's the God's honest truth. Now, obviously, I didn't teach Andre the wide slice on the serve. I mean, I showed him for 5 minutes. So that's not the point. The point was, what a wonderful, first of all, how his mind sharp as a tack. Second, how gracious he was, and is really amazing. He was 15 years old or 14 and a half at that time. So anyway, now let me get to what I was saying is I was involved in player development before it started. Then I helped write it. Then I was a national coach, director of coaching, director of technical development, director of high-performance coaching education. In 1996, I wrote a huge report to the USTA, which didn't really get much play, why the U.S. would lose their dominance in tennis within 10 years. And I detailed it, men's and women's. I said to a lesser extent in women's, but I said that it's almost already happened, and I also said that at one point we would not even have players in the top 10. So I've been involved in a long time, and I have a lot of I probably have more practical experience
and background in this area than almost anybody in the United States. Just serendipitously, it kind of happened that way. And now after I left the USDA, I have 12 years in the private sector. I will simply say that there are a lot of wonderful people working in the USDA. There are a lot of talented, caring individuals that are working in player development. And I have a lot of respect for these people individually. I do believe, as I tried to point out many years ago, the system is flawed and that inadvertently the USDA has damaged the developmental process in the United States with the competitive structure, with the way player development is structured. It does not work in our society and with a country as large as ours is the way it would, say, in a smaller country. But even people refer to France. To me, quite frankly, France is an example of a lot of very talented players, and I mean, but a lot of their best results came from players that came outside of their development program. My point is, I have great respect for the French and what they've done. However, I don't think they're a good role model for us for what the United States needs, completely different country. So to talk about the different specific factors, it would take hours and hours. Do I know it? I know it like the back of my hand. And the developmental process, I will tell you that the bond, that if you look at any great player that's developed in the United States, any great player, I repeat that, and I'll say it one more time, any great player in the United States that is developed had a bond with a private coach, and if that might have been a parent or someone was closely monitoring, guiding the ship, that cared greatly about that individual. Period. In every single case. And when you damage that bond, and this is just one key point, when you damage that bond, whether or not that person is supposed to be an expert or not, then you are inadvertently damaging the long-term prospects of that player. Period.
Hmm.
Now, unless that bond is replaced by something as strong as otherwise. People say, was Mr. Williams a great coach? I don't know, but he was certainly had a great influence on his daughters. Jimmy Everett, both Jimmy, you know, Martina had her individuals that was that were influential for her, Monica Seles, Pete Sampras, Jim Courier. You go down the list, and there is always somebody there. Minus that, or if you inadvertently damage that, you're going to get a lot of mediocrity. You'll get a lot of good players, but a lot of mediocrity. Secondly, it is critical, the environmental, the competitive environment in the United States. When I was growing up, we had 48 men in the top 100. Now, granted, the game has gotten far more international. However, the United States still should be the dominant nation in men's and women's. And there's enough people playing. But there are, you have to have the best competitive environment in the world. We used to have that. We don't anymore. So those are two things, the bond of the players and the competitive environment. Now I could go on and break it down and systematically explain from beginning to end where, what the effect is of certain things that are being done from my perspective. Just because I've been through this so many times and seen the process now hundreds, if not thousands of times. So that's
let me interrupt you one Let me interrupt you one sec, Nick. We have a caller on the line, and we're just about out of time on our live broadcast, so I want to just let them get their question in, and then we're going to come back.
Yeah.
Caller from 786-273, are you there? 786-273? Are you there? Oh, okay. Well, maybe they were just listening in. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead.
No, that's fine. And you were saying college. College is a wonderful attribute here in the United States, but it is not the – it in no way is damaging or adversely affecting world-class development. A player can go and become a world-class player going to college, and they can, whether male or female, most likely they're not going to be Grand Slam champions if they're going to college. It may not be politically correct to say that, but over the last 20 years, that has been blown out over the years pretty clearly. It's a real process to be it takes many years to be really a Grand Slam champion, something in those on those lines. Not a top 10 player, that's very doable. Certainly Isner would be an example of somebody who can achieve that level, but I don't believe that you get the likes of Djokovic, Nadal, Federer, Murray, these type of talents. I do not believe you can be splitting your time going to college for 3 or 4 years and achieve that. Now, I say that I love Wayne Bryan. I've learned a lot from Wayne. Wayne and I are extremely close, and I've known the Bryan brothers since they were 10 years old, and we are very, very close friends and all of that. But the doubles is different than the singles. Mm-hmm. And I do not believe that you will see Grand Slam champions going to college for 3 years or 4 years. Possibly a year, yes. But beyond that, I don't see it happening. Not in the men's tour, not in the women's tour.
Interesting. Well, we are out of time, unfortunately, which is killing me because I have a long list of questions for you. Will you do me the honor of coming back on the show another time so we can delve deeper into this stuff?
Lisa, it's been a lot of fun. It'd be my pleasure to come back on, and I would look forward to it.
Oh, awesome. Okay. Thank you so much. I really, really appreciate you sharing your wealth of knowledge with us. And like I said, I've got a whole list of questions for you, but I'll save those till next time. So thank you.
That's
Have
great.
A great Monday.
Thanks a lot. Pleasure. Look forward to meeting you in person soon.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That was Coach Nick Saviano. I want to thank you all for tuning in this week. I hope you enjoyed the show. He was phenomenal. And like I said, I really do have a lot more questions for him. So I'm planning to get him back on the show in the near future. Next week, we have kind of an interesting show. I have one of the creators of Friend at Court, which are the rules that we follow in tennis. And she will be on discussing the various rules. So I urge you to tune in, to call in with any questions, or if you'd like to email me questions ahead of time, lisa@parentingaces.com is my address. And thank you for tuning in. Have a great Monday, and I will talk to y'all next week.